My name's Nathan Shepherd. I've been at Esri for 17 years in software development side for about 12, mostly doing 3D things. If it's 3D related, I kind of was in it or around it for a lot of time. And on the way, I made a lot of interesting 3D maps or scenes, and here's some of them. Here's some of them here. And a couple of years ago, I thought it'd be a good idea to help people learn how to make interesting scenes, sort of rather than by trial and error, actually try and give them some ideas on how to do things. And I'm here with a good friend, Ken Field.
Me, that's me. Hello, I'm Ken. So I've not been at Esri quite as long, 5 years, just over 5 years. I work on the mapping systems team, helping the guys develop Pro. And I'm a sort of a 3D skeptic. So I'm either here to sort of temper Nathan's enthusiasm for 3D, or conversely, Nathan's going to convince me that 3D is the way to go. For everything. So you'll see that actually the difference between mine and his set of pictures and maps is there's much more 2D stuff in mine. Although actually when you look at it, there's a lot of depth in there as well with terrain and all sorts of other things. So let's have some fun.
Yeah. So you know, having Ken making 3D maps has just been a very big pleasure. So in case you didn't know, this is actually an indoctrination session.
So when you close the doors.
Yeah, exactly. So put your wallets in your back pocket quickly. But this is a call to arms. So 2D maps, cartography, been around for many years. It's very well established and lots of rules about how to do things. And 3D is kind of a bit more, if it feels good, maybe we'll do it. So we want to give you some tips and tricks about how to make ones that maps that communicate, 3D maps that communicate, and don't get you in too much trouble. And so first of all, we always like to tell people why create 3D views. You know, 2D maps are very important and still cover there's a lot of reasons to have 2D maps. The number one reason why people make 3D views is because it's cool, man. And you know, the man is optional. We can just say it's cool. But if you're feeling particularly with it, you can say it's cool, man. It really means there's actually many reasons. So like stacked vertical content is one, things that are stacked on top of each other, you just can't even see it in 2D. You see it from the side, see it in 3D. It also shows data in an easy to understand form. We walk around a 3D world and we see things in 3D. And we've been actually making these kind of 3D maps for a long time. So there's a couple of examples here. There's from 1487, there's a 3D map of a city map of roads in Greece, and then one even older from China. It's actually a really long sort of tapestry style a painting called Along the River. It's just amazing, and it's just this isometric view all the way along a river and a village. So it's kind of like a good way to engage with people. They see things, and they get engaged, and they come in. So it's cool, but it's also got a purpose. Having said that, when someone says, I'm going to make a 3D map, they quite often make this one. Why not, right? You've got to start somewhere. There's no judgment, judgment-free zone here.
I'm judging that.
Yeah, well, except for Ken. He's the mean one. All right, so here's population stick. So the height of the stick matches the population. So Manchester, 2.8 million. Leeds is 1.5 million. And from this viewpoint, it actually looks about right. It kind of makes sense. Gives me a bit of a feel for it. But then I navigate the camera above, and I look straight down, and I can't even see the sticks anymore. I'm not learning anything anymore. So people can move the camera around in 3D. And worse, they can move that camera right down close to the ground. If you look at this just sort of as it is, you think Birmingham's smaller than Leeds, which is obviously not the case. So, you know, there are a couple of problems immediately with, you know, what seems like the simplest thing ever. So what can you do? Well, right away you can add labels. And you can add real-world size symbols. So the labels, you can see Leeds 1.5 meter. Oh, you can read it, Manchester 2.8. So now I can read it and I know what it is. Even if my brain is saying that Leeds is giant, I can look at those numbers and can correct myself. The real-world size symbols too, like those cylinders are actually all the same size. Take advantage of the fact that we know that something close to us, you know, I've got a giant hand, you know, I've got a tiny hand. It's like, you know, we know that perspective is involved. So you can sort of bring that in. Another trick is to use like isometric or axonometric views, and that's so there's a vanishing point. Everything sort of, there's two parallel lines, but they seem to vanish off in the distance. That's what, you know, the distance away that it vanishes is based on about 50, 55 degrees. That's what our eyes are. If you use the camera, zoom in. What you do with an isometric or axometric view is we make them parallel. The computer can do that for us. And in that case, you see on the left that, you know, absolutely Birmingham's bigger than Leeds, even though it is further off in the distance. The thing about this view is it can kind of look a little bit funky if it's moving around, like it hurts your brain. But in screenshots and images, it's a good way to go. So just some words to make sure that when we say them later, you go, oh, that's what he means. There's four main elements to a view. There's the surface, that's the mesh. So the ground is the most famous surface. Lots of things live on the ground. But you can have subsurface geologies, you can have ozone layer, you can have a thematic surface for crime or population or whatever. So you can have surfaces. And then you can put things on that surface. The most famous thing or texture that you put on a surface is aerial imagery. So ground is the most famous surface, and aerial imagery is the most famous thing you put on top of that. But you can mix and match them. Features are things that live on or relative to the ground. So an airplane is up in the air, knows its real height. A tree sits on the ground. And all of these things can sort of work together, and they tend to be volumetric symbols. And then the last one is marginalia and effects. It's actually pretty easy to get lost when you're in 3D, so it's nice to have a north arrow or at least some way of some bookmarks and some other things to get back to places that you know. When you make styles of scenes, the photorealistic or the real world scene, 87% of all scenes that are made are real world photorealistic. And 56% of all statistics are made up on the spot. So a lot of people are making photorealistic scenes. And there's a place for them, and we'll talk a little bit more about what it means for this session in a second. On the right, you can see the cartographic representative. So that's a flat world, and we've got extruded population, countries. It's got nothing to do with the real world. It's very sort of representative or cartographic. And in between, you mix them together. So we've got real-world buildings there, and we've actually got aerial imagery. You can't see it through the semi-transparent polygons we've got there. That's representing the police districts. And then we've got these little symbols on sticks showing where all of the fire stations are. So that's kind of like a mixture of the two. In fact, that's quite often the best way to go, is to sort of take some photorealistic elements to give some context to your view, and then use cartographic representations to communicate information, which is what maps are all about. So photorealistic scenes, so that image is actually ray traced, which means we knew where the sun was, and we bounced it off the glass on the building, and we bounced it off the rippling water, and then we took a photo of it. And doesn't it look amazing? Well, for cartographers, there's no decisions to be made in this. So we're not going to talk about these at all. It's not really cartography. There is a place for real world scenes, photorealistic scenes, but we're not going to talk about them. We're going to talk about cartographic scenes. And this is everything you can do here. Everything you can do in 2D, you can do in 3D. You can use shape, size, offsets, textures. All of these things can be put into a text. If you're not trying to recreate the real world, you can put anything in there as long as it's communicating and not sort of lying to people. There's two general worlds, the 3D types of scenes you make. Global, so that's the whole planet, just kind of like Google Earth, and we have this mood, this view mode. It's really good if you want a global context. You've got data that covers the whole planet. You want to see it on the planet. You want to see curvature of the Earth. Maybe you're at a good altitude, and you want curvature of the Earth allowed for. It tends to be more realistic. Local is sort of more for projected coordinates. It tends to be for smaller extent content. So like maybe a building or a mine site, you tend to come down into local view. And you can, in between, it gets blurry about which is the best one to use. Here's the thing about 3D. It looks good and sounds cool, but it can be evil. It could really be evil. So if we look at the little pie chart at the top there, that blue thing, that little blue wedge that looks like it's giant and it says cool, that's only 20% of that pie chart. But we've zoomed in really close to it, made it fill the screen, and we're using 3D to lie to you. The other thing is content can be hidden. So as you fly around, if you go down behind a building, you can't see what's on the other side of the building, or maybe you can't see what's below ground. We've got continuous scale issues. So in this, that little map there, in the foreground, near the camera, down the bottom, we can see some building footprints, and as we move further away, we lose the minor roads, and finally we're left with only the major roads. So you've got to have all of your scales joined together across many scales. You see many scales at once. It's easy to get disoriented in 3D. You bump into things, you go underground, you get in a flat spin heading out to sea. That's, you know, it's kind of can be hard for people to get into it. There's also large amounts of data. It might be slow to render, and it can be hard to author, so it's scary. But there are some benefits. That's why we're all, well, it's why we're making them and having some fun with them. So familiar symbols, a green ball on a stick looks like a tree. It just looks like a tree. I don't need to tell anybody that a green ball on a stick is a tree. So you can sort of take advantage of shapes that are familiar to people. And that bottom, the bottom example there, we've got walls as barriers for crossing major roads. So you don't want people crossing. If you're walking around your neighborhood, you can't walk across a freeway, maybe you can't walk across a major road, so you might be trapped in this little urban island, and we can represent that using walls. We can also, and a big part of 3D is actually tends to be attribute-driven symbology. So here we have some wind vectors that show how wind is moving through these little urban canyons. And where they're semi-transparent, it's light wind. And as it gets more solid, the color gets darker, that's stronger wind. So we're using color here. And each one of those little arrows knows the direction it's facing in, and that's why it's rotated in that right way, and also its strength of the wind. And we can get both of those parameters into this view. Another really cool thing about 3D is you get superpowers. You get to fly. You get to use X-ray vision. You get to expose invisible things and go underground and see using radar, LiDAR content. So we'll sort of see what that looks like. So this is downtown Sydney, and we've got some buildings. As we come in close, we're using transparency, our X-ray vision, to see the floor. So we can see where people are living and working in Sydney, and we see how many floors are available. We can even see that even floor data exists. And we can be selective about this. So instead of being stuck with lead, we can say, you know what, I want to see the areas that have... I'm going to use my X-ray vision. I'm going to pause it right here. To see the places that are available for lease. So if I want to lease an entire floor in this building, I can see what's available. If I want north-facing or south-facing, I could... I can just look at that and understand what that is. So we're using our superpowers as we're flying around it and looking through stuff. Okay, how did I do that time? Even faster. No, look. Oh, it was longer. It's 12 minutes instead of 11. Mm-hmm. That's the end of the slides. So the rest of this presentation, we're just going to go backwards and forwards and show you some cool scenes that we've made and explain the cartographic decisions that were involved in making them. And we're going to start off with, you know, something light, something not light, the opposite of light, the JFK crime scene. And we're going to look at it in a web scene. So this is on the web, so it's accessible. The thing about this particular content is that we worked on it together, we wanted people to be able to explore this and sort of make their own decisions about what happened and what it meant and understand that day. You can't do that unless you can sort of zoom around and look at things. So that's the first thing. The other thing you'll notice, it's only a small area. We don't need to see the entire planet. We only want to see Dealey Plaza. And we can see that Main Street comes here, and then Houston, and then Elm. And if you look closely, we can see we've got the cars. And the spacing between the cars is representative of the speed. So it's sort of going slowly here, and then after shots are fired, it picks up speed and goes away. So that's another little cartographic technique. We've got sort of time shown here. Rather than just showing the car in one place, we showed it its path and its speed. Another little trick we have in here, we're going to come down to this infamous window. So we've got these sight lines, and what I've done here is we've put a vertical slice and a horizontal slice representing the line, kind of like a crosshairs that go all the way down, sort of representing crosshairs. And you can sort of line up and see the three different shots that were fired from this window. And come down, and another little thing you'll notice here is it's taste is the word I, is it good taste? Is that the word I'm?
Respectful.
Yeah, respectful. Is that we didn't use realistic models here. This is, you know, sort of crash test dummy style models. It's a serious subject, and you know, wanted to be respectful about that. But we did color code the two mannequins. And what's going on with that pink?
Oh, it's Jackie's pink dress.
That's Jackie's pink dress. Yeah. So Ken actually got the RGB of Jackie's pink dress and actually made that exact color. Mm-hmm. Nice touch. So this is the magic bullet area. This is where the bullet came through and did all sorts of funky things. And they thought that that must mean there was another shooter back here on the Deltex building, or maybe another one up on the same in the book depository. So that's that little area. I'm going to come over. So if you've ever seen any footage of this, you might be familiar with the Zapruder video. So let me just sort of reveal a trick of what's going on here. So this is approximately where he was standing. He was just there filming it and, you know, moving the camera around. And by placing individual frames from that video into a sort of a lined up direction, we can sort of see how he was sort of holding onto that going around. So this is, you know, this is Zapruder, the 313 frame, and then as the car drives off. And all we've done here is just place these frames in the right place for the viewpoint. And we'll use this technique in some other things as well. I've also added, you know, important viewpoints. So this is where the grassy knoll shooter was suspected to be from. And if we click on some of these little icons, you see they're not real things. They don't look like they belong, so they invite being clicked on. And it says, oh, you know, 400 footprints and cigarettes behind here. So you can sort of read a little bit more about the crime scene. And all of these points contain metadata about the scene itself. If we come up here to the top, another reason why there was a lot of thought that something shady had gone on is when they asked people where they thought the sound came from, this was the result. So we've got like a little 3D graph here. So 52% said, oh, definitely the book depository. 32% said, no, the grassy knoll. And 7% said, oh, it could have been both or either. So when you add those things up together, you sort of see a really strong reason why there was thoughts that the shot had come from this other direction. So this is just lots of different things. We actually have, Ken has a blog post about this. So if you do a search for JFK Interactive with a K, you'll find this page, and sort of explains a little bit more about it. And you can click on this link here and open the scene, and I invite you to, you know, check it out and learn a bit more about this event. We're going to that. I'm going to take you over to Ken.
Thank you. Cool, man. I just realized something.
Uh-oh.
We put a 3D pie chart on it.
You loved it.
Just thought I'd mention.
That's what you could have done.
I think the one thing I just want to follow up on what Nathan shown you is the fact that most of the stuff that was going on there was cartographic. There was very little photorealism in there other than the textures on the buildings. You know, it was all flat colours, symbols, and the sort of standard stuff that we might use on a 2D map. But the beauty of it is the interactivity, and that's going to be something that sort of feeds through all of what we do. The fact that we can now make these things interactive makes 3D much more compelling. Because people can explore it themselves and click and move things around and see things from different angles. So, moving on to this. This is a map that I hope many of you will be reasonably familiar with. At least you have maybe seen it before. This is a famous map by Charles Minard of Napoleon's disastrous march to Moscow and back, 1812, 1813. The map was made in the mid-1800s. And he made it as a excuse me, a sort of anti-war thing about the futility of war. But it's been described by various people like Edward Tufte as, you know, possibly the best map or the best statistical graphic of all time. It's really just a flow map, and we start off with you know, the great army, 400,000 or so people here, and they march across the land, stay in Moscow for a bit. Nobody there to beat or beat up, and then they sort of retreat. And really, the flow line is showing you the decimation of the troops. And so I look at this and thought, well, this is great. It's the best thing, you know, it's the best map ever. So I thought, can I improve it? You know, and, you know, can we make something in 3D? Excuse me. Make something in 3D that gives us something additional, gives us a reason to go into 3D. So I started off with the data, and this is it. This is the entire data set for that map. It's just segments with the amount of troops for each of those segments. So that's how we make a flow line map. So I'll show you how we make the 2D version, because that leads directly into the 3D. Because I knew the start and end points of each of these segments, I had an origin lat long and a destination lat long, I could use the XY to line tool to say, here's my starting vertex, here's my end vertex, create me a feature between these two positions. And that's what I've got here. This is the skeleton of the 2D map. Okay, well, what do we do from that? Well, we could use proportional symbols, a proportional symbol flow lines to create the map. Let me just take the segments off. But that looks a little odd. And actually, if you sort of remember the image of the original I've just shown you, these lines are actually much thinner here than they were on the original. And it's kind of curious. I only noticed by doing this recreation of a famous map that actually Meinhard had exaggerated the size of the lines just to create a slightly better aesthetic to the map. So even that classic map that we've just seen is cartographically rendered. It's had some work done on it to fool us a little bit into seeing things in a particular way. Now, ultimately, then, I wanted to do the same thing. So I actually went for unique values so I could modify the thicknesses of the lines to get it as close to Meinhard's as possible. And we kind of end up with the final map all nicely put together. Now, when I say I wanted to see this to see if it could be done, actually, it was a case of I wanted to see if we could do it in our software. I knew you could create this because Mene-Jan Krak, a professor of cartography in the Netherlands, has done it before and has also written a great book called Mapping Time, which you can see down in the spatial outlet if you wanted to. So I thought, well, let's try it. So you go into a scene and you put in a little segment of a base map. Look at that, I remembered the V key.
Look at you.
Hey, I learned something yesterday morning. Suddenly found out yesterday morning the middle button of my fancy mouse doesn't actually do what it's supposed to do, but Nathan said use the V key. And, okay, what are we going to do with this? Well, let's add the group one movement in, and you can begin to see a little bit about how I've generated this. Let's go under there. Perhaps these are easier to see. So they're tubes. Oh, what am I doing?
It's unclear.
It's been a long day. they're tubes. And that's just one of the renderings when you go into 3D. So you can make strips or tubes or walls or other different features just by symbolizing things different ways. So these are the proportional tubes. But the key to this is that the tubes now don't no longer go on a flat surface. This is why you do 2D. There we go. They no longer go on a flat surface. They've got elevation. They move from a different Z-plane as an origin to a destination. Now, the way in which I did that is used the feature to 3D by attribute tool and said, okay, I want my line to be created, but I want it to have a different elevation at the start of the line to the end of the line. And that gives it this trajectory through space. Okay, so that's great. I can add in the vertices, which actually are just proportional spheres, and they sort of round off the ends quite nicely. let's try a route. No, I don't want to do that. I want to rotate it. And if I add in stationary periods, this is where I think actually we start to get something quite interesting, because this is Moscow, and they stayed in Moscow quite a considerable amount of time. And the argument goes that if Napoleon hadn't stayed in Moscow quite so long, then they wouldn't have experienced this harsh winter in the retreat, and maybe not so many troops would die from environmental conditions. Anyway, there were other parts of the movement of the troops, the second and the third front, if you like. But actually, I showed this Nathan, and he said something like, cool, man, but... he said, you're in my realm now. And he said, actually, I'd quite like to see this the other way around. I get a sense that maybe we should have a flow or a trickle down rather than what I've got, which is the start of the troops moving up and then the decimation at the top. So actually, Nathan just said, well, you can do that pretty simply by reversing the values, multiplying all of the elevations by minus one, flipping them. And that created this... it's been an awfully long day, hasn't it?
3D is
do you
not
want to drive it?
3D is not scary. That's what
I'm
going
to
be doing. What did
you say? It's difficult to drive.
Zoom to full extent or something.
Okay. Come on.
There you go.
All right.
Ooh. You're a little close.
Yeah. Let's zoom out a little bit.
There you go. See? How easy that was.
Thank you. It's very useful having Nathan sat next to me. And I think it works better like that. The flow now sort of moves down a little bit. But it wasn't quite complete. So we added in some cities as just extruded squares, but also put in these little vertical leader lines to connect them particularly to the areas that were a little bit further away so we can see where they were in the particular journey. What cities were they in? We put on the temperature for these... I'm not even going to attempt to zoom in, because the temperature was very important on the retreat. So we had little marker symbols in there, 3D marker symbols that show in a font that give us that indication directly on the map. But then we also added some time slices. This is just a sort of a polyline extruded as a not extruded, shown as a little sort of strip, and then the base heights moved to create. If I add the time slice labels. October, September, November, December. So we now get some sort of impression of the temporal dimension going vertically through this space-time cube. So that's the sort of Maynard map, and I think the benefit of 3D in this case is this ability to see these vertical periods of stationary movement, or lack of movement, I should say. The other thing I would say just briefly is it works beautifully for this, I think, because it's a single line. It's a simple line. If you've got a lot of track logs, maybe you go jogging and you've got loads of them, or bike paths, if you start to put many, 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 many more lines on, you quickly get a very cluttered appearance. So space-time cubes like this, lovely for simple representations, but maybe not for very complicated ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was really good work. And then just a little subtle thing. You can see here this is the stationary thing. If you think about it, the slope of this is also the speed of the troop movement. So we are actually adding a couple of little extra elements that weren't in Maynard's map into this 3D view. It's lots of grim stuff,
death
man.
And death.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do some typhoons. Typhoons. This is one typhoon. Typhoon Nabi, 2005. And this is the path it took. We're sort of in a global view, looking from out in space. And this is the path it took. And the thing that I was interested in when I was making this one was trying to get as much information or as many attributes out of this one data set and show it all in one go. So if we sort of flop down and sort of come in a little bit. So some of the things that are going on, all of these are actually point features, and the spacing between them is every 12 hours. So even already I've got the XY, and then the gap between them is how fast it's going. You see it slowed down here, and then it picked up speed as it sort of petered out and went off. So that's kind of the XY and the speed. The other thing was I was kind of thinking about how to show barometric pressure. And this sort of goes to using a familiar symbol. So here we have like just a pressure tube, and you can see that the pressure's dropping and staying low. As we come around here, the pressure's still really low, and then it starts to pick up as the storm dies out. So we can sort of graphically see something that's really you know, something that we can understand. Once you know this is a pressure tube, you understand that that's falling pressure. And we've just got a couple little lines around it, so you can help line them up and see the differences between them as you go around. So that's barometric pressure. These things here, those little icons, the bigger they are, the more wind speed. So we can sort of see how the wind actually sort of maxes out here and then drops off. And the actual icons themselves show the wind direction. And if we come into a bookmark, you know, we still want more. So we know these are every 12 hours, and this thing here means it's nighttime and daytime. So it's midnight and midday. So now I can see which is the midnight and midday time. So I'm getting an idea of the time. The date is just being shown here in a little label, and I can see the knots and the hectopascals for them. So all up, there's 8 parameters here. XY, speed, barometric pressure, wind speed, wind direction, time, and the date. And it's all in this sort of pretty simple little view. And you sort of like should challenge yourself every now and then to sort of come up with ideas where you can take advantage of something that makes sense to someone to communicate could be a pretty complicated thing to represent, rather than relying purely on color or size. That's it. Cool. So, and now Ken is going to do isometric prisms.
So the useful thing about 3D to me when I see this sort of work like those typhoon things is the problem with cartography is trying to get the information on the map in a nice, easy to handle fashion. But having the third dimension actually gives you a whole extra set of capabilities to make multivariate symbols rather than trying to do them in 2D. There is a fine balance though. I think Nathan nailed it with those, but you add maybe one or two more variables onto that and you soon start to get a very overcomplicated graphic. So instead, look at it. This is great. Don't we love this sort of stuff? Ooh, I can spin things across a globe. So instead of extruding to create tubes, why don't we extrude real geographies and put them across our nice virtual world? And this is the 2012 election data, which I'm very fond of using. It's giving. It just keeps on giving. And it just means I've got to change all my maps in November, but never mind. But here is a problem, because we've got problems of occlusion. We've got data hidden behind other data. This is just extruded by total votes. And, we can spin it around. But when we look in perspective, we get these sort of problems, these columns that go out into the middle of space. And when you look at a map like this, actually what you're trying to communicate to people is you want them to be able to compare the height of one column to the height of another column across the map and gain some sense of relative size or amount. I want to know, does this county have this sort of similar amount of total votes as another county? And you can see that if I put sort of Florida, this county in Florida right at the front, well, not only have I occluded this county all the way at the back, but I have no ability to look at the comparative size. And even if you imagine me flying across this, look how Florida's getting smaller, that county in Florida, as this county in Washington State is getting bigger. So I really have no way of understanding this particular map. So the trick here is twofold. One, you could just put it into a local scene. So a projected data gives you a flat map. Okay, and that helps us a little bit in trying to understand things. But if I move this on its side and create a kind of a sort of a view of the map in aspect, a bar chart almost, this is this county in Washington State, and this is the one in Florida. So this would suggest to me that the county in Florida is at least double the amount of total votes. Now then, I'm going to have to flip out to an old friend here, called ArcScene, only because the little bit of trickery isn't in Pro yet.
Yet.
I'll keep asking for it.
It's not mine.
Okay. And this is ArcScene, and this is the same data that we just had a look at. But if I flip this 2D into 3D, and I sort of move it around a little bit. Now look at those two bars. This is the one in Washington State, and this is the one in Florida. Actually, they're really rather similar. The one in Florida is only marginally more than the one in Washington State. So it's the same flat map, right? What have I done? Well, actually, all I've done is change the view settings to give the angle of view a value of 1. And you don't really need to know why this has worked, but effectively it's created an isometric projection which makes scale in the foreground of the map, and the scale in the background of the map the same. They're consistent. This was the same technique used on the famous Bollman map of New York or the Constantine Anderson map of New York. And it just allows us to compare. No. It's in all dimensions. It's in all dimensions. It's in 3 dimensions. I've got a blog about it that explains it on ArcGIS. So this gives us an ability to create an isometric view of your 3D data, if the purpose is to be able to at least compare the size of columns. And if I switch it to, let's say, 50 and zoom in, you can see we're back to our perspective view. So even there, Florida and Washington, the one in Washington State, are very different. So it equalizes scale across the entire map. And publishing that online is as simple as going to the tool export to 3D web scene, which creates a file that you can then upload to ArcGIS Online, which will render that map in an isometric projection using the City Engine Viewer. I think that is that for me.
That's that for you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So the thing that's interesting for me about that example is is that we wouldn't know. Like, you just showed us both, and if we didn't know about that little trick, we would believe one over the other. So as an author, you've got a lot of responsibility to lie as little as possible.
Or as much as possible, depending on what you want to say.
Lie carefully when you're using 3D. Okay, I'm going to go to another one, another space-time cube example. So this is water usage. It's a space-time cube for Merced County in California. And by space-time cube, there's an XY component, and the vertical is Z's. So each one of these is a different year. And see how that works. You can sort of see, oh, these people are good with their water and these people are bad. And we can thin out which ones we look at by using this slider here, this range slider. We're just going to look at the people who are kind of bad. Now, the thing that's interesting about this is that I can't see inside this. Like, this is like an egg-shaped thing that's kind of protected by this border. And there could be holes in the middle. We can't see this. It could just be a little shell. So we have a real challenge here. So unless you've got a way for people to thin out interactively, go, oh no, wait a minute, it's not empty in there. We can sort of thin it out and just see the worst people and see they're consistently bad water use of people. You need to provide ways of investigating data. So this is something that as a static scene without this control would be not very useful at all. But the ability to sort of interactively drag this out, if possible, is good, or just maybe a bunch of scenes that you can turn different layers. You can say, I'll just see the worst people, and then the not so bad, and then the good people. You could turn them off in layers. That's another way to go. The other thing that's interesting about this content is that when we look from the side, there's this kind of like this flat level here. This is 2 years, 2009 and 2010, where no one's bad. Well, even these most evil people of all are taking a year off being evil. Like, they've just got just a couple of people over there. You know, we don't care about them. But most of the people are good. And so something happened in 2009 and 2010. I don't live in the area, but maybe there was higher rainfall, or who knows what it was. But that's interesting, right? So we've discovered something by interactively working with our data with this kind of view, the space-time cube, and it gives us something more to discover. And you can also see there's another year where everyone was bad. Like over here, sure, there's this little column of badness, but there's only one year where everything went pear-shaped. And we don't know why, but we could ask. Now that we've seen that pattern, we can ask. The other thing that I did that was a little bit interesting with this scene was, if I turn off the ground thing, is that when it's floating like this, it's hard to see, like especially this guy here, it's like, where is this on the ground? You can't line it up because you're sort of rotating around, hope no one's feeling ill. But it's hard to line them together. So I've actually added the data a second time and drawn it on the ground. And then for each one of these cells, I just draw it semi-transparent. And it adds up. So you can sort of see sort of underneath here. In fact, if I turn off the stacked blocks and just look at it as 2D, you can sort of see that these people are worse. These people are marginal, but the real problem area, if the water usage, is right here. You've got nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. And you can sort of thin that down and shrink it down again. So this is just kind of using filters and then the, sort of an XYZ space-time cube for it.
Did you see the talk of the spatial temporal stuff yesterday?
No.
They had a 2D representation of the 3D stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For Kenneth's sake, I guess. So you could explore the data, not 3D, you get full 10-year perspective on.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Yeah, you can totally do that. So you can use a time. So this is time, and I could enable this time slider, and we could see it through years as well, individual ones. And if I'm looking from above, it's just like 2D.
They did the hotspot.
You do know about the 3D hotspot thing, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, Lauren and.
It puts it into a 2D layer.
Yeah.
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 With incredibly complex symbology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is more.
15 different categories.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do you like this? No, thanks. That's all we're after.
Yeah, forget about that.
Okay. We're going to move back. 3D cartograms.
Mm. Okay, so I have a problem with 3D space-time cubes when we're dealing with polygonal data for A, the reason this gentleman said here, that it becomes complicated symbolically. And, you've got to have a lot of conclusion, because you can't see inside a lot of the columns of data very much. I think some of these techniques are getting further towards helping that problem, but it is inevitably a problem. So I thought, well, let me have a go. Let me see if I can do something cartographically that helps that problem. And it was also another technical challenge, because although I've told you never to use sort of a grid on a curved surface, just because it looks silly with all these extrusions, I thought, I wonder if I could get away with it for a very small area of land. Now, I happen to know a very small area of land, which is the former European neighbour of Europe in the United Kingdom. And we had a general election last year, and I got that data, and I thought, I'm going to work with this to try and get it into 3D, just to see what I can do. So the first thing I need is some bins to bin my data. I want to do it as a cartogram, not just as a standard geographic area, a little bit like the American version I've just shown you. Now, the problem with this map is the projection. It's in Mercator. If I just used any of our fishnet tools or generate hexagon shape tools, it's going to create equal area hexagons on top of a base map that is not equal area. So I needed to actually use a program developed by Kevin Saar at the University of Oregon to build hexagons that are also warped in the same way as Mercator is warped. So that builds a set of tessellated hexagons. And if anything, that should at least convince you of the horrors of the distortions in the Mercator projection, right? There we go. And I built a few different resolutions of this data. And you know what? It's just pretty looking at it, isn't it? So these are... I've actually put these on ArcGIS Online, so if you want to use these, you can feel free to go ahead. So let me go back into... Let me zoom to the UK and put on the UK's hexagons. So I just build a mesh. And sure, it looks kind of wonky in 2D, but in 3D it'll look fine in a minute. And then I just clipped it out. And I picked 650 hexagons to build a cartogram, broadly respecting adjacency between political constituencies and trying to respect geography wherever I could. You can see clearly that actually the number of Scottish polygons are much smaller. Nobody lives there. And actually, this bit is bloated because everyone lives in London and so on and so on. So anyway, there's my sort of structure. So you go into the 3D bit by just copying that data into a scene. And the first thing I did was put together a base map, because I don't want to just put this over imagery. I don't want to just put this over a topographic map. I wanted to create a somewhat abstract geography to map this on top of as well. I even put in little boundaries, political boundaries. There you go. That's Belgium. They live in Europe. This is France. They live in Europe. So that's my base map. And on top of that base map, I put a series of too many tech workshops. I put a series of extruded polygons. I extruded these by total number of votes. So this is a layer of also-rans. These are the people that didn't come anywhere close to winning. And on top of that, I put a layer of people that came in third place. So this is the same extrusion of the polygon by total vote, but the base height of that polygon, so the layer that it sits on, is now the total vote from the layer underneath it. Okay, so they start to appear to stack. And the colours are the political affiliations. I'm afraid we have a few more than red and blue, which is probably part of the problem. Second place, so this is the sort of runners-up layer again. Now it's stacked on top of two layers of total votes. And then the winners, stuffed on top. Okay. And then I thought, well, what happens if you look at this from above? You don't see inside. This is the problem I'm talking about. So even though I could strip back the layers, which I think is one solution, I don't get to see all of the data at once. So I built what I'm going to call a capstone, just a lump of... So I went with the sort of devil's post pile, sort of giant's causeway metaphor for all of this. I thought, you know, these sort of basaltic columns of political nonsense coming out of the coming out of the geography. I don't know whether this necessarily works, but it's certainly colourful. But it's proportional symbols constrained within the hexagon. So you get a feel for the majority colour in each one, and they're surrounded by narrow strips of other colours. Hard as a multivariate symbol to look at and to understand, but nevertheless it gives you some sort of sense of the context if you're going to look from above. And then I sort of put the marginalia in the context around the map as well. So, you know, a little legend actually on the map, which is the columns of total vote for each political party. And I used vertical columns as leader lines and the progressive reveal of labels. I think it's quite nice and it works. And then a little information point over here that you can click on. And I published all that online, and you can go and take a look at it and interact with it and sort of strip back layers or look from it above. And I think it's a way of using layering to do that. And then I applied exactly the same... just get that to full screen. Exactly the same approach to creating this map of the results from the... UK referendum that was now, what, last week? And these are the idiots that voted to leave the European Union. We're supposed to be apolitical, but I don't care. So, and you know, you can click on each of these columns as well. They support pop-ups. Northern Ireland, they wanted to vote to remain a member of the EU. This was the turnout and the vote and so on. And, you know, I think you get some sense, and I can turn off the winner's layer and see what the losers look like and so on and so forth. So it becomes reasonably compelling. You don't have to use cartograms, but it equalizes for area size and gives us a different perspective on the map.
We should leave that subject immediately. It makes Ken very sad.
Which makes my decision to come here a very good one.
Okay, so we're gonna switch gears, and we're gonna go to 1830, give or take, and some Japanese art. So who recognizes this painting? Everybody does. It was a Hokusai. It's a woodcut carving painting, and around 1830. And I don't know, 18 months ago, 2 years ago, one of my co-workers, not Ken, interestingly, but another co-worker, said, "Hey, Mount Fuji's in this painting. I wonder if you could figure out where the painting's set." And I love a challenge. So I found out where the painting was set. So what I've done here is I just sort of estimated the height of the inside the painting, the perspective height of it, and then figured out how far away it would be. And the cool thing about these paintings is they have really good names, like Great Wave of Kanagawa. So I found Kanagawa, and I went off the coast about the right distance and placed it here, and I gave myself a score. This one gets a B-, about 12 kilometers off the coast. And sort of zoom out, sort of see where that is. So this is Mount Fuji. Now, the thing that's interesting is that Hokusai made 36 of these. And you know, once you've done one, what's another 35? So I figured I'd go around and find some other ones. And we found some really good ones. We'll go over here to number 12 in the series. And here it is in the top right. And I'll wait for my base map to catch up. And again, these great names. Everything should be called things like this. Sunset over across Ryogoku Bridge from the bank of the Sumida River. Great, I found the river, and then I found the bridge. And if we go look at the actual painting itself, you can sort of see, okay, it's on the bank, we're looking this way, and then the bridge is on our left, and we'll come down and line that up. You can see off in the distance, lines up. So the thing that's really interesting and cool for me is that with nothing but the metadata of the painting name, which is embedded in there, and sort of a little bit of GIS knowledge, we're within maybe 100 meters of where someone in the 1830s depicted this painting. And I think that's just really, really cool. And we just sort of ran with it, found some other ones. Now, what about if it's you can sort of come down here and see this one's really good because it's like a little land bridge that comes across to the island. So the island name was given here. Here's a little land bridge that was a little sandbank they used to walk across back in the day. And we can come down and line that one up. And again, we can give ourselves a mark, that one's with an A. So it gives us the name of the island, and we can just use the geographic information around it to line it up. What about one that we didn't have much information about it all? So number 34, but you know, I was feeling pretty confident, and then I guess number 34 out of 36. This one's called the Fuji from the Mountains of Totomi, which is a very large province. And the image doesn't really have much to work with. But I found a little area where there's a trail going along, and there's a little hill to the left and a little hill to the right, and lined it up. So they're all sort of graded on how good they are. And if we come back up to the overview, that's the sight lines to all of those 36. So you can see that most of them are from the Tokyo direction. A couple were imagined, if you like, out in the bay. One way up here, and then some others over here. So you sort of, he really did a really good job surrounding Fuji and all of these things. And that's just kind of using a technique of lining up an image with the reality behind it. Okay.
Yeah. People love it. I love that. I think that's fantastic.
That's good stuff.
Okay, so I like Lego. Always have liked Lego since I was a kid. And, you know, still often buy Lego sets and build them just to relax. And I thought, well, why don't I do it at work as well and get paid for it? So this was actually predominantly for a different project completely, which was to build a 2D Lego-looking map for a completely different project. But I wanted to also just try and see whether I could put it into 3D and see whether it gave me anything extra. So I'll just explain briefly how I built it in 2D. You effectively create a fishnet grid across the US in this case, and then you dissolve to get some polygons, and then you perhaps go online and get the Pantone colours for Lego and use them exactly.
Do you like colour?
I think colour's important.
I think you're obsessed.
And then you sort of use a point and polygon to put a point in each of these square polygons, but you actually end up symbolising them in a very particular way and then putting a label on the top. And then you sort of create a playmat. You create a playmat, and you can do all sorts of other things and put... actually, where are we? There we go. Plinth online. And there's the sort of final base map. Looks a little bit like that. So that's 2D. And, all right, putting it in 3D. So these are just square polygons, right? So here is the playmat in 3D. And it's got just a little bit of extrusion to give it a little edge. There's a little grey edge. And these knobbly things have got a little bit of extrusion to make them look like a Lego base map. And then you can put the map itself on, which it now sit on top of the base map. I'm going to call it a base mat. And, you know, they're now symbolized. And actually the lighting conditions in 3D in the viewer actually creates a really nice texture on this, makes it look a little bit like, well, Lego. And then I thought, well, let's do something more useful. So I created a density surface of the location of all of the Lego stores in the US. And I added those on as bricks and created this very scientific representation. And then I thought, well, we need to see where those points are. Where are the Lego stores? And, you know, apologies if you've seen this map before, but I still love it. So I put little lightsabers on top because they give us a great way to represent the position of things. And then you don't stop there. If you're in, you're all in, right? So you actually create a series of models. Actually, you don't. What you do is you steal them from the internet. So these are just points elevated to a particular... position z-axis, and you replace the point with a model, a collada model or something else that has 3D shape in it. So these are just little Lego models of Star Wars ships. And it's kind of fun, but it sort of illustrates that you can stretch 3D as far as you want and in many ways, except when you show this to kids, they want real lasers, they want to be able to move the spacecraft. And I say, this is a sophisticated GIS package. And you might want to do that in something else. So that's Lego. Oh.
Back. Fun times. Okay, so Lego. So Ken goes, I did this Lego thing. And it was cool, man. And really good. And I'm thinking, what can I do to beat Lego? we kind of like feed off each other. Like, Ken will show me something, I'll go, well. And then I'll show him something, I'll go, well. And then we come back, and it's like it just escalates from there. Yeah, cool, man. So it's good. We occasionally impress each other, so it's always good fun. So for me, it's the question, you know, Lego. I'm more of a Bugs Bunny guy, and I was wondering, you know, Bugs Bunny digs to China. Where is he digging from to get to China? That just seems really wrong. Serious questions need to be answered.
We're getting into the serious stuff now.
Serious questions. So here's Beijing, and here's a, you know, kind of giant stick. But what I've done is I haven't actually just put a stick up. I've gone, you know what? Let's put that through the whole planet. And then pop it out the other side. So there's like the olive on the stick. We'll come round, and I'll just... do that. So if you're digging to Beijing, that's where you want to start. And I thought that was pretty important to figure that out. So this is kind of like phase one. And then I was sort of thought a little bit more about it. I went, that was cool. But what if I put sticks all the way around? Then I would find the boundary. And I thought, why do that? Let's take China. So here's China. And this actually was like a test of the software. I wonder if the software will do this. And we'll just sort of look through the planet. So what I did is I said, let's go negative extrusion 8,000 miles and see what happens. And the northern part of China needs to come out on the southern part of the other side, because that's got to go through the middle of the planet and come out the other side. So we've got this polygon. We're going to run it through the planet to a tiny little point and then blow it back out again on the other side and discover exactly where you can dig to anywhere in China from the other side of the planet. And then, you know, just sort of to finish it off, and then actually makes me think there's some conspiracy theories, is I thought I'd better do that for Australia as well. So here's Australia. And I thought, I wonder what's on the other side of Australia. And we'll go over there. There's water.
That's brilliant.
You can't even dig your way out of Australia. You'll end up in the water.
So who made this planet?
I feel like the UK knew what they were doing when they sent all those convicts. Like, yeah, dig your way out. Let's see how you go.
We might be coming over to Australia.
Okay. So moving on.
Oh, it's me.
Yep.
Changed it already. Okay, Mars. Everyone's made a map of Mars this year. I thought I'd better not be beaten, so I'm going to make a map of Mars. And I did a 2D version, and this is digital elevation model. And I've rendered this in the colors that Mars is, because we've all been there, right? We all know what it looks like. We all know we can grow potatoes on Mars. And those of you who didn't get it need to see The Martian with Matt Damon. Good film.
It's a better book.
A better book. There you go.
There you go.
So I just built this. This is just a 2D version. And, you know, there's some interesting stuff on Mars, like these sort of rift valleys, and these are really quite impressive. And I thought, well, they need a little bit of, you know, texture in there. Let's make it a little bit more dramatic, and let's add some more hill shades in and do some crazy stuff. And all right, that's getting to look a little bit more like a crazy planet. And then I thought, well, perhaps we'll fill it up with water. And there we go. Let's get some crazy stuff in there. Fill it up with green water, because water's going to be green on Mars because of the atmosphere is different. Okay. Anyway, enough of the 2D, but I like that, so I was going to show it. In 3D, you've got exactly the same data. It's just positioned in around the globe, wrapped around the globe, with an elevation surface. You can just about make out that that is a custom elevation surface, so it is properly representing the elevation of Mars. But I looked at that and thought, that's not the Mars I want to know. That's boring. It's flat. So I go into my cartography textbook 101 and go, you know what? I can use exaggeration. So if I can actually get the mouse in the right place, let's exaggerate elevation by 10 times. And so just take a little moment to render. Now that's the Mars I want to see. These are horrific valleys. Look at these, very uninviting chasms. And if you sort of go along a little bit further, there's some volcanic activity. There's some Olympus Mons. Look at the size of it. You know, this is far more impressive. So using standard cartographic techniques, you know, exaggeration. Why not? You often exaggerate things. You can actually create something that looks kind of interesting. And I'm probably not going to play this because we haven't got much time left, but the new animation tools in Pro are absolutely wonderful. So you can put in a set of bookmarks and you can effectively create an animation through those bookmarks. Why don't I just play it? There we go. No hands. And you can just set these bookmarks to go, and you can kind of zoom in, and the camera automatically starts swooping around and changing its position to get in line for the next keyframe. And you can modify some of those things as well as you're going along. And it just becomes a nice way to illustrate not just 3D, but to animate. Animated maps are useful, and perhaps animating something that exists in 3D is a similar thing to providing somebody with interactivity in 3D. Okay, we'll stop that there, even though we're about to fill it up with water.
Oh.
No, go on.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
We can come back to it Wednesday. Okay, so we're going to move along. We are a little behind. We don't care too much. It's the last session of the day, so sorry about that.
Except they want to go to the bar.
They want to go to the bar. Okay, well, we better not be in the way. So I'm going to do floating cloud layer next. So this looks great because there's clouds, and as I pull forward, I can see there's clouds above me. What's a cheap way to do clouds? It's just to grab an image, and if I bring out the properties for this layer, you can see that it's actually at 17,000 meters. So it's not on the ground. It's actually 17,000 meters above it. So when I look around, it's kind of this nice little thing above me, and I get this nice little cloud effect. This image was downloaded from NASA. It's the famous blue marble image. So it's just a cloud. So I can look around. I'm playing an animation now too, so you know, I'm very competitive. No hands also. I'm going to use my nose to navigate as we go. A little trick, as you go through something like the cloud, you just sort of look vertically. You sort of pop through it really quickly, and it looks a little better. I'm going to hit pause, and we'll come down and just sort of highlight the trick, if you like. So it's just a wafer-thin image that's 17,000 meters off the ground. You don't have to be on the ground. You can put a texture on a non-ground surface, and then you get this nice effect. That's that one.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No messing around.
Cool. Some of you may have seen a very, very popular infographic over the last few years called The True Size of Africa by a designer whose name I won't mentioned for reasons which become obvious, because he did it wrong. And in true sort of nerdish fashion, I thought, well, can I do it correctly? And so the problem is that he put all these different shapes of countries inside the outline of Africa, but he'd used a Mercator projection to generate the original shapes. So they were wrong when they were sat within Africa. So even though the point of his graphic was great, and I got into a little debate with him about this, and he said, well, it doesn't matter what the size of the shapes are, it's the point that's the point. I said, no, actually, if you're going to do it, you may as well use the right shapes, because it still says the same thing, just correctly. And then he went and did a 3D version last year, and with the same sort of mistakes. And I thought, I wonder if I can recreate it in Pro. So here we've got a globe. I've just got a sort of a set of outlines around the globe. And the countries, I'll show you the sort of semi result here. The countries that you can place over the top of Africa. Come on, hurry up. There you go. Okay, they're just sort of some shapes randomly positioned or organized over the continent. So the question is, how do you go about doing that? Well, let me demonstrate on this little island here. And if I go into the edit tools and I select the polygon for Great Britain, and I want to move it, because I do want to move it, let's sort of... Oh, come on. There we go. Where do I want to go? I don't know. Let's go... Let's just put ourselves off Portugal. Okay, so... You end up putting, there you are, the UK is now moved completely. So that's the project. I've actually really done that, haven't I? So have I saved that? No, discard.
Revote.
So this is the people are trying to do that, aren't they? Okay, so let's go back to map and explore. Let's move this back. Let's clear the selection. So that's all I did to move those countries around to get them over Africa. Now, I added a few of the little extra niceties in. I put a graticule in. I put a background in. I put Africa in as a different colour in order to make it sort of pop from the rest of the countries. There's the background. Come on. And because we like flare effects in cartography, I added a sort of a flare effect using some of the geometric effect tools in Pro. There we go. So we've got a little bit of an interesting base map. But I didn't just want the countries in 2D. I want them in 3D. So I just extruded them. And you can start to sort of see, it's just an infographic. I'm not bothered what's on the other side of the world. This is going to end up as a print graphic, maybe. But still, the ability to put things in 3D was useful, and you put some labels on so that people know that we're looking at different countries. And so that's the true size of Africa done correctly.
Okay, are you going to do your population sticks too?
Yeah.
Okay.
We've got 3 minutes.
We've got 3 minutes. Fine. All right. Well, I'll be quick. So I'm going to do a historical ship race. So I had some interesting. You can download historical ship data. So in 1788, if you want to get from Jakarta back to London, you have to kind of go this way. It takes a little while. And over a 20-year period, I actually found five different ships. Well, actually, the trip was done five times, but by General Coote was the name of the ship, did it twice, Seahorse, Kent, and Queen. And, over 20 years, they'll never at sea together, but I wanted to have them race. I think that's just what they should be doing. So I used some time offsets to get them all back. So they all had the dates and that they went, and I just sort of time offset to get them all starting on the same day. And then we have ship log information for where they were each day. So as I step through, you can see they're off they go. I can sort of turn around and watch them go. Look at Kent go. Kent's on fire. General Coote's not very good. So this is kind of interesting, but it's not something I would want to share interactively. What I'd want to do is create an animation. So as before, you see I can create some keyframes. All of these keyframes are time aware. I've got one for each day, and I sort of spent a bit of time lining them all up, and I ended up with this video. So another way to share 3D content is as a video. It doesn't always have to be an interactive map, especially when it's a race. So they're off, and down they go, and Kent's off to a big lead, and General Coote's low behind, and Seahorse is catching up, and Seahorse is the eventual winner, spoiler alert. And we're going over the planet here. I'm going to catch up, going to get to Madagascar in a second, and then keep going around. So I just sort of did this. This is the first 60 days of the race. And they all come down here, past Cape Town, and they get some funky stuff goes on around there. I don't know what happens. Some alcohol might have been involved. It's unclear. I don't put that in the log. And they all end up stopping at up here at Jamestown. So and they all refit here and then continue on from there. So it's kind of like just a fun way of sharing things. So that was your historical race.
Yep. Okay. This is world's population or. Cities. It's a layer of cities, okay? And the bit sat behind here is population data totals. And in 2D, all I've done here is just colour them with random colours to say, right, well, I can delineate... I didn't want to do that. To delineate, different countries for different colours. Okay. Put that into 3D. And what do we get? Well, put the dark grey canvas on first of all. Just give it a minute to. It goes, and there's the same points but wrapped around a globe, and so I'm not going to take you through all these interims. I'm just going to show you the result. Doing extruded polygons, and they're not polygons, extruded sort of points, just to create something that looks pretty. So I've already told you today, one of the things that I really don't like with. Extruded anything on a globe is that actually you can't measure the size of things between things, and there's stuff on the other side of the planet. So why did I do this? Well, I did it because it just looks cool, man. And if you're maybe doing a book on 3D cartography, that might make a nice front cover, or just a little animation, or just because your boss asked you to do it, so you thought you'd better please him. And that's it.
Nice. Thanks again. So now we're just going to finish up. So we went through a lot of stuff and we talked about some rules. If you get the PowerPoint, you can actually see the last couple of slides and it gives you some of these. You can actually go through them and feel like you learned something instead of just sort of seeing lots of cool stuff. So just review this at your leisure. You can get it down. And there's actually just a couple of last things to go through. Ken does a lot of writing and has multiple blogs. So this is the sort of thing you want to go to and see, read some more about this. The JFK Interactive and all those other ones are available here.
Or search for Nathan's YouTube channel.
Yeah. And then Ken is writing a book on cartography called Cartography. It's coming out April. You want to say something about it quickly?
No, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
And there's some stuff in there on 3D as well.
There's a little bit of stuff. And you know what's better than a cartography book with a little bit of 3D?
No, I don't know. Tell me.
It's a 3D cartography with nothing but 3D. So I'm also writing a book, Mapping with Altitude. It's going to come out summer, so it's a little bit further away, but it's coming along. First draft almost done. Okay. And then that's the Extruded Australia.
I put a better cover on it.
I like this one better than yours, man. Oh, sure. You want to take a photo?
Oh, so fair warning, that blog is me just ranting about crap maps. All right.
It'll be just like this session. So there's other sessions left. There's a Thursday map design one, a thematic map design Thursday. So only the Thursday ones are left now.
Terrain one tomorrow is going to be cool in the morning.
The terrain one? What's that one?
Or did you axe it? The one at the bottom, map design for relief representation.
There you go. 8:30 tomorrow morning.
And the thematic maps tomorrow afternoon.
Great stuff. All by Ken. we have to tell you that if you get a chance, fill in the survey, let us know what you thought. If you had any comments about how we can improve it, that's great. And are there any questions?
Yeah, how did you do it?
Yeah, how did you do it?
I don't know. Most of the techniques are actually pretty simple. So that's why we're writing books, is so you can look it up. And some of these are described in detail on Ken's blog, talked a lot about how you did every piece. But most, it's like lots of, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time, right? So you just, the little things, little decisions as you go.
How do you give the dots
in the Lego blocks? Oh, okay. So the squares from the original fishnet are just square polygons. Just think of them as polygons. And you just get the centroid of the polygon, do a point in polygon, and it's feature to point, and then it gives you a point in the center, and you symbolize that with a circle and just extrude that a little bit, and you position its base heights at the same height as the top of the square block that you're doing. So actually with a lot of these, it really is just messing around with extrusions and base heights, moving things around in the vertical plane. But a lot of the techniques we've used have been repeated multiple times today.
And I noticed you were doing most everything in the RGX Pro.
Yeah.
You can label in ArcGIS Pro, but it's very rudimentary. There's a lot more work to be done for the labeling in Pro. Yes, at least there's something, right? Even if you hate it.
I showed a little bit of it with that Mars example in Pro. We were again a bit short of time, and I've now switched my computer off. But if you go to the gallery, carto.whatever, there's a 3D Mars thing in there, and you can start to look at how the labeling does work. So it progressively reveals, which is kind of useful because it means that you don't have this massive clutter on the screen. You can position it on top of a point and billboard it, and you can have it so that the lettering, the typography remains in the plane of the view, even if you move the actual geography around. So even though it's rudimentary, actually the basics are pretty much covered. It's kind of turn off and onable, but it's a good start, I think.
Yeah, there's more to do. Yep.
The things like the water usage, mm-hmm. If you were to use a single color, graduated color, mm-hmm. but a single tone, instead of transparency, if you look at it from above and get a real notion through all the layers, when it's something where it's the same measure where how much water is being used, I know they were doing outliers, and you know, it's a hot spot analysis, so it wasn't really water consumption so much as extraordinary water consumption.
So are you suggesting that it's semi-transparent so you could see through many and see if they're the same color through? Is that what you mean? Or?
No, but you get an increasing...
Oh, yeah.
The darker the color, really the more water is used over the 12-year period, where you could get a notion of the...
Yeah, so that's the sort of semi-transparent white squares on the ground. I did that trick where they were all semi-transparent, and because there was five of them, it looked darker than where there was only one of them. That was the trick I used there. Transparency in 3D is you're at the mercy of the computer, how it renders it. It doesn't always render things in the right order. So transparency, when you're looking through things, is actually very problematic in 3D. So use that wisely. Use transparency only if there's nothing behind it. If you've got a set of nested things that are semi-transparent, they don't always add up together in the right way. Yeah.
And it was kind of a different tool anyway. So this was very much about a cartographic way of displaying a sort of simple theme, and but which can vary vertically. I mean, that the 3D hotspot thing is a different thing. They're trying to do a different thing with the analysis. Yeah, and it's exactly that. It's the same as the 2D, you know, hotspot analysis. They're trying to find different things in the model than Nathan was showing.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.